I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, where the Democratic Congress failed President Obama's hoping to succeed in overhauling health care. Today, as expected, he released his $950 billion health care proposal in advance of that all-day televised summit on Thursday. Also this week, the jobs bill front and center as Republicans face criticism from one of their own for saying that last year's stimulus bill failed to create any jobs. Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, here to set the table for the week for us. Gail, start with health care and the president speaking today. You know, we heard a lot of this leaked out over the weekend, but what jumped out at you?
Well, two things. One, that he is clearly aligning with the Senate's version of health care reform. There isn't a public option in this plan. But two, and very interestingly, the White House spokesman today emphasized that the president is open to maximum flexibility on how to get this plan through the Senate, which translates they might try to do it through a process called reconciliation that does not require 60 votes, but only a simple majority.
Okay, now we have to take our pens and pads out here. Reconciliation, this means that you go line by line with proposals, and it has to do with those proposals that have to do with the budget?
Well, you put it through under a process that started out to help Congress reduce the size of budget deficits. The idea was anything that goes through with reconciliation has to lower deficits. Now, if the Democrats can figure out a way to repackage this plan to signal the deficit-lowering features, they can move it under this very complicated procedure. But the thing to remember is, suddenly 60 isn't important. 51 is what's important.
Because that's all you need.
That's all you need.
Right. Well, now, I would have thought if I heard the president say he was open to flexibility, I would have thought that was an olive branch being extended to Republicans. It sounds like you're saying that what you think he meant was you either go along or we're going to push it through using reconciliation.
That's right. Well, the question that the spokesman answered was, is the White House open to using reconciliation? So the context of the answer was that. Mm. And Republicans are anticipating this. So Mitch McConnell said over the weekend that using reconciliation would be an acknowledgement that there is bipartisan opposition to this bill. It's another backroom deal and a sign that they're going to completely ignore the American people. Doesn't sound too conciliatory.
Well, no, it seems like an odd way to start the week, given that we have this televised summit on Thursday. What else do you think is going on? And also, tick through some of the other things that President Obama did list in his suggested proposal today. And then, you know, how are Republicans going to respond to that?
Well, one of the very interesting ones was to amplify a point that Senator Dianne Feinstein made last week. I think President Obama's biggest ally right now is Anthem Blue Cross, who in California announced a rate increase of up to 39%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a number that gets people's attention. It reminds you that, you know, maybe government is needed here after all. And what the president is proposing is allowing Health and Human Services to, in effect, curb, rein in, or block rate increases that are deemed unfair. 39% seems, on its face, unfair.
Well, but then you get into the tangle of who should regulate insurance industries. Many states have their own regulators, so what's going to be the response to this?
Oh, it'll be a food fight. Yeah. There's no question. What it does, however, is give the president a whiff of momentum here. Here's a reason to continue this discussion, which has dragged on for a whole year now. The country wants Congress to focus on jobs. The American people have kind of lost interest in health care, and what the president is trying to do this week is get it back clearly on the table and see if he can get enough momentum to get something through before having to turn decisively to the economy before the midterm elections.
So Republicans and Democrats will be digesting his proposal today ahead of the summit on Thursday. Meanwhile, you mentioned jobs. This morning, President Obama spoke to the country's governors and shot back at Republicans who've criticized his stimulus package, saying the president saying tens of thousands of first responders kept their jobs, 300,000 teachers. You know, we know the Wall Street Journal and the Boston Globe, other papers, have been finding press releases from Republican legislators in particular who publicly dissed the stimulus, but then also were in favor of projects in their area. We had newly elected Senator Scott Brown here in Massachusetts who said the stimulus bill didn't create a single job, but papers here printed his press releases touting the jobs that were saved. And this weekend, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger took his Republican colleagues to task on ABC's This Week. Let's listen.
Anyone that says that it hasn't created a job. They should talk to the 150,000 people that have been getting jobs in California. If it is teachers, if it is university professors, if it is people that are building infrastructure and stuff like that. I mean, there's in every category, there's jobs that have been created in California.
No, I could hear Republicans, Gail Chadwick, saying, well, he's not Republican enough, you know, there in California. But what do you think in the minute we have? Is this a shift?
Well, I think the point that members are responsible in the end for what happens in their districts is very important. Harry Reid has a critical vote tonight at 5:30, where he is moving. It's the first vote on his scaled-down version of the health care bill. He's trying to get Republicans on board to Olympia Snow in Maine. He's offered small business tax breaks to Susan Collins in Maine. He's offered timber tax credits. Scott Brown, apparently he's talking to constantly, trying to pick up some comments he's made in Massachusetts along the lines you just quoted. But we'll see where that goes. I mean, at this point, Republicans don't have much interest at all in cooperating with Democrats. Democrats own the jobs bill. They own the economy. They're owning the war. They own health care. And the American public doesn't like what they're seeing. If the 2010 elections turn out to be a referendum on the Obama administration, that's good for Republicans. What the president wants to do this week is turn it into a choice between what he's done and what the Republicans are offering.
Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor on the Week Ahead in Washington. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
We just mentioned California. The state is also considering a law to list animal users in an online registry, just as they do sex offenders, as a way of tracking animal abusers who often go on to commit other violence. California voters also passed a law to give crated animals raised for food more room. Well, our next guest would say, do more. Melanie Joy is a psychologist who says people should conduct thought experiments about animals raised for food. Here's one, and it may be difficult for some people to hear, and that's her point. But let's say you're dining with friends and you ask, oh, what's the recipe? Your host responds, well, start with some marinated golden retriever. You probably can't go on, right? Well, Melanie Joy asks, why can many people continue if she says, your host, it's a pig? Melanie's new book is Why Do We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows? She joins us now. Melanie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with one of the answers that you come up with. It's the psychological, that's your field. You say it's our perception, our schema. This is the psychological framework that shapes how we think. Tell us more.
When we're born into a system, that a belief system, a widespread belief system that conditions us that some animals are for eating and some animals are for loving, we perceive animals very differently based on how we've learned to classify them. Dogs are for loving, cows are for eating, pigs are for eating.
And you take students at UMass Boston, here in the Boston area, through a sort of Socratic exercise where you say that this schema that you're talking about, this thought process we've been taught, gets exposed. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll put the word dog on the board, and I'll ask students to list all the adjectives that come to mind when they think of dogs. And, of course, the list of adjectives is often quite flattering. Dogs are loyal, they're our friends, they're our family, they're adorable, they're fluffy, they're cute. And then I'll do the same thing with pig. And not surprisingly, pigs get a much less flattering list of adjectives. You know, pigs are fat, they're sweaty, they're gross, sometimes they're stupid. And then I'll ask the question to the students, okay, well, why do you say dogs are adorable and lovable? Well, because I've lived with a dog. I know a dog, and they'll share their personal experience of having known a dog personally. Most of them have. Why do you say pigs, for instance, are stupid? Well, because they just are. Well, how do you know? Well, I don't know, from movies, from TV, from magazine. Why do you say pigs are dirty? Well, because they are. Whenever you see them, they're covered in dirt. Why do you think they're covered in dirt? Because they're gross. They like dirt. And then I'll point out that pigs, in fact, don't have sweat glands. So they're not sweaty pigs, and they roll in mud in order to cool off. And as we proceed, you know, I challenge their perceptions of each of these animals. And I'll ask them, well, do you think it's possible that, you know, pigs can be intelligent and friendly and loyal like dogs? Well, it's possible, sure. And I'll point out that pigs are, in fact, considered to be more intelligent than dogs.
You point out that pigs, when they're named, will come, as dogs do when they're called, that the pigs are very sociable, that they interact, they can express feelings, they have feelings.
Right. I point out that pigs are highly sensitive, highly intelligent beings, who are also kept as pets occasionally. So, and students rarely disagree. And if I ask the whole class, well, do you think pigs have feelings? Well, of course they do. They'll say all animals have feelings. And then I'll say, so why do we eat pigs but not dogs? And often someone will say, well, because bacon tastes good, or because pigs are bred to be eaten. Well, then I say, why do we breed pigs to be eaten? And inevitably, the students will say, I don't know. It's just the way things are. What's very interesting is that across cultures and meat-eating societies, people tend to have a select few animals out of the thousands of animal species that exist that they consider edible. They tend to see their choices as rational and all other species as offensive and disgusting to consume. What this comes down to is there's a dominant widespread belief system that I call carnism, so entrenched that we don't even see it as a belief system or an ideology.
Whereas vegetarianism is constantly explained to people.
Exactly. And we tend to think it's only vegetarians who bring their beliefs to the table. We see meat eating as a given, not a choice. But when eating meat's not a necessity for survival, it is a choice, and choices always stem from beliefs. And carnism is organized in such a way to enable humane people to participate in inhumane practices without even realizing what they're doing. Most people would not willingly participate in action that causes animals to suffer.
Well, now you're getting into the territory we've been over on the program many times through documentaries like Food Inc. We've seen for decades now how animals are slaughtered. You say that if people could see some of the things you describe in the book, baby pigs pulled from their mothers, smashed on the floor, chickens kicked by workers, cows cut up while they're still alive because the process just didn't kill them enough. It's just horrible. But we know at this point, it's not as shocking as it was even a decade ago. Is it possibly true that people do know that and they still want to have their food that way?
Well, it's a great question. The primary defense of the system is invisibility. And the primary way the system stays invisible is, by keeping the animals out of sight and therefore out of mind. What I think is that people have this knowing without knowing. On one level, they're aware of the unpleasant truth that animals have to die for their plate. But on another level, many of us just prefer not to connect the dots. And that's really what I address in my book, not simply what is the truth about meat production, but what is the truth about the system that conditions us so deeply, that teaches us not to feel, that teaches us to turn away from the very issue that requires that we bear witness in order to transform it.
Well, but then there are people who say, I raise animals for food humanely. That's Melanie Joy. Her new book is Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. More in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about what social psychologist Melanie Joy calls carnism, a worldwide belief system, she says, allows us to keep some animals as pets and kill others for food. And Melanie, you say this is invisible. We don't see slaughterhouses. But you say people can break out of it by seeing something, as you did?
I do. Like many Americans, I grew up with a dog who I loved like a family member, and I also grew up eating meat. And, I didn't recognize the inconsistency in my attitudes and behaviors toward animals as I would pet Corky and eat my burger. And, at some point in my life, I was exposed to literature about how animals are raised and killed for meat. I decided to stop eating animals, but I know that I had been exposed before then. The information was always out there. I just wasn't ready to connect the dots.
I'm guessing that you are not in line with the Michael Pollans of the world, who, once he found out how animals were slaughtered, said, look, the people are going to eat meat, so let's make the process better. What do you say to the people who say, I will only eat grass-fed, free-range meat that's humanely slaughtered? I mean, they feel that at least that is something of a better life for the animal.
Well, there's a lot of literature out about, it's called the humane myth, and the myth of so-called humanely raised animals for meat. It's not as humane as people are led to believe that it is. If we were to, you know, do an experiment and say, well, would you be okay, for instance, with so-called humanely raised golden retriever or Persian kitten? Would that be okay? And if we're not comfortable with that, but we are comfortable with doing that to some other species, well, then I think we need to really examine our perceptions.
Sometimes, as you point out, it takes one event to flip somebody around. And I just want you to talk about one that happened actually right in Western Massachusetts. It was a cow named Emily who was on the ramp to the slaughterhouse and bolted, got her 1,500 pound body up over a fence. Workers chased her at the slaughterhouse, and it started to change the town.
Well, what happened was Emily disappeared and she hid in the woods, and police were out looking for her. The owner of the slaughterhouse was obviously trying to find her, and the farmers in the area and citizens were actually leaving out bales of hay for Emily, trying to help her.
Lying to the police about whether they'd seen her.
Right, giving misleading information to help Emily, and she ended up being bought by the Peace Abbey, which is a nonviolent living center. They have a vegetarian awareness education center as well, and a small sanctuary for animals.
But that's just one cow.
And that's exactly right. It's because it was just one cow that people were able to connect with their empathy for her. It's because they saw her as an individual. One of the psychological mechanisms that we use, that carnism uses in order to distance us from the reality of the meat on our plate, where it came from, is that we tend to see these species as simply generalized groups, and it makes it much easier to consume their meat when we don't think about them as individuals who have lives that matter to them, who have preferences, who would choose not to be harmed if they could.
In fact, many people, and they've done, you can talk to kids about this, they don't even make the connection between the meat on the plate and a cow.
That's right.
That's Dr. Melanie Joy, an animal activist and University of Massachusetts professor of social psychology. Her new book is Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And those are the questions she asks of her students. Melanie, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
We want to touch on Toyota. Two congressional committees start hearings this week to look into Toyota's huge recall. And internal documents subpoenaed for those hearings are raising new questions. Last night, Toyota released a statement saying their main priority is customer safety. But these documents seem to indicate the priority is saving money and end-running regulators. Justin Hyde is Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. Justin, give us a thumbnail. What do these internal documents say?
Basically, these documents show that Toyota believed it saved $100 million by avoiding broader recalls involving sudden acceleration in some Lexus and Camry models. They consider that a quote-unquote win for the company, among other safety issues that they negotiated with the federal government that year.
This was prior to the recent events that led to the recall. So what are critics saying about the tone of that internal document?
Well, this is not something that I think any company would want to see paraded around right before they go into Congress to testify. I expect there'll be a lot of questions, especially in light of the recalls that have come since.
Because it doesn't seem as if there was concern for drivers expressed in those internal documents. It also raises questions about NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency, and other regulators. But you're writing, too, that there may be a lot of emotion expressed in these hearings because you say that the relatives of that California state trooper whose terrible accident in California this past August triggered events leading to the recall, that relatives are going to appear.
Two of the parents of the couple that died in the crash in Santee, California, will testify and question some of the official verdicts of the crash, that it was strictly the format that was the cause of that Lexus careening off an interstate.
This is a driver who called 911 when he couldn't stop. And you write that he was driving a loaner car, a Lexus that had been loaned to him by a dealership, and that just days before, another driver of that car couldn't stop it either?
Correct. A few days before, the Saylor family borrowed that Lexus from the dealership. Another man had reported that the car started to run away from him on a freeway. He was able to get it over to the side and said he had to yank hard to pull this mat from underneath the accelerator pedal. It was later found that the mat was for a Lexus SUV and shouldn't have been in that sedan. As far as the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is concerned, it was the floor mat and the floor mat alone. What the family and some other people connected to the crash believe is that with all the new questions that have arisen about Toyota's electronics, perhaps, or some other flaw that could cause sudden acceleration, that the accident needs to have another look.
Well, and Justin, you're hearing more today about criminal investigations involving Toyota cars. What are you hearing?
Today we found out from an SEC filing that Toyota's received two subpoenas, one from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in Los Angeles, but another from a federal grand jury in New York. Both subpoenas involved information regarding sudden acceleration in its vehicles.
That's Justin Hyde, Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Detroit Free Press, on what's shaping up to be another not-so-good week for Toyota. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And one last look forward. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a victim of child pornography wants judges to order anyone convicted of downloading X-rated images of her to pay restitution, and some judges have already awarded her millions. Also, as we wait for the Oscar winners of 2010, we'll look back at the last time there were 10 Best Picture nominees, 1943. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Iceland's Patsy Cline, Here and Now. The ice is hot at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Tonight is the ice dancing final, where a Canadian and an American team are ranked 1 and 2. And how about that U.S. men's hockey team beating heavily favored Canada yesterday 5-3? Los Angeles Times sports reporter Helene Elliott is on the line from Vancouver. And Helene, the men's hockey win. Hockey is Canada's sport.
Absolutely. And it was a terrific game last night. But as some of the U.S. players were saying afterwards, too, you know, let's not go overboard here. It was a terrific game and an incredible atmosphere. But it's a preliminary round game. It wasn't a medal round. It wasn't an elimination game. You know, let's just see if the U.S. and Canada happen to meet again, what
right.
would happen.
Right. And, of course, people noted that today's the 30th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice. This is when the U.S. men's team had their victory over the then Soviet Union in Lake Placid. So we're not there. Is what
no,
you're saying.
Not
yeah.
even close.
Yeah. In the meantime, women's hockey has already advanced to the semifinal. The U.S. women meet Sweden today. Sweden was the team that beat the U.S. in the 2006 games in Turin. So what kind of rematch are you expecting this afternoon?
Well, if you're looking for karma, the coach of the U.S. women's team is Mark Johnson, who, of course, played on the 1980 Miracle on Ice team. So I think he's going to be 2-0 in big games on this date in February.
Tonight, of course, ice dancing. This is an event that the Russians, you know, pretty much owned. Not this year. Tell us who's in there.
Well, the Canadian duo of Tessa Virtue and Scott Moore have been terrific, and the American duo of Davis and White, who actually make ice dancing athletic and worth watching.
That's Merrill Davis and Charlie White. And just touch on it, the ice dancing going in, there was a lot of controversy about costumes, and there was the couple last night who did wear the very controversial Aboriginal costume.
Yeah, apparently they did a lot of research and they reached out to some of the Aboriginal folks here in British Columbia and in Vancouver and got a kind of a blessing from them.
That's Oksana Domnina and Maxim Shabalin, the Russian couple, but the audience didn't seem to like it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's still some parts of ice dance that are over the top, and
I think that's just a tad.
But there is some athleticism there now. I mean, that to me is the key. It used to be if you couldn't really jump and you didn't want to be a pair skater and be tossed around like a sack of potatoes, you went into ice dance. But now I think they're getting better athletes in there, and it shows in Davis and White, certainly.
Well, it's fabulous to watch. Ahead, we have women's figure skating, always a marquee event. But we just want to note, what a great weekend it was for American athletes. You had alpine skier Bodie Miller, short track speed skater Apollo Anton Ono. He took bronze in the 1,000, becoming the most decorated Winter Olympian, U.S. leading the medal count. How's this going over, though, in Vancouver? Because the U.S. sometimes can be seen as having maybe a little bit too much bravado.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that kind of tense but brotherly relationship between the two countries. I mean, Canadians, with good reason, kind of feel like they're overwhelmed by the U.S. They're very sensitive, too, to what people think of the Vancouver Games, and there's been a lot of people who think that these games have not been among the best, and Canadians are kind of worried as to how they're perceived around the world for staging these games.
Well, and of course, you know, we've talked a great deal about how they began with the death of the loser. But since then, what's the take? Because from this vantage point, you know, if you put that aside, which is hard to do, but if you do, boy, they've seemed thrilling.
It really is hard to put that aside.
Yeah.
For the American athletes, there's been breakthroughs in sports that we traditionally haven't been good in. Canada's been a lovely host in terms of people being polite. You know, the U.S. hockey goalie was telling us last night that he would go out in the street and people would be trash-talking to him. So we said, you know, what do you mean trash-talk? What were they saying? And he said, they'd come up to me and go, you're the American goalie. Go Canada. That passes for trash talk here. So you have to love a country that's trash talk.
I know. Yeah, well, yeah.
Well, we give you Celine Dion, so there.
Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times in Vancouver. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I like Celine Dion. I must have an inner Canadian. Back in just 30 seconds, here and now. An appeals court judge in Florida is weighing whether a lower court was right in ordering a pregnant woman to abide by her doctor's demand that she be confined to bed rest at the hospital and stop smoking. Samantha Burton was 26 at the time, 6 months pregnant, and a working mom with two small toddlers at home when prosecutors won a court order that required her to stay in bed at the hospital to preserve the life and health of her unborn child. 3 days later, she lost her baby anyway, but she's appealed the decision with the help of the Florida American Civil Liberties Union, because she says she wants to keep other women from being what her attorney calls incubators for the state. Well, given that this involves the rights of an unborn child, it's a case that's being closely watched by abortion rights supporters and opponents. Let's start with David Abrams. He's Samantha Burton's lawyer. And David, she went to the hospital on her doctor's advice because she was in premature labor. But that stopped, and they still felt the fetus was in jeopardy. Now, doctors would say, you know, we can't just stand by and watch if we think a fetus is in jeopardy. But why did Samantha object to her doctor asking her to stay for bed rest?
Well, I think Samantha Burton had a couple concerns. One being the satisfaction with the care that she was receiving at Tallahassee Memorial and through the physician, and the other issue of whether or not that recommendation was in her best interest. Samantha Burton was a woman who had two children that she would be separated from, and her legitimate question, I think, would be one of, why does it have to be here in this hospital?
She also asked for alternatives, another hospital, a friend offered to take care of her and let her have bed rest there. And what happened then?
Basically, her doctor and the hospital lawyers came into her room. They set up a telephone. And without the assistance of counsel, without the benefit of a second medical opinion, without access to her medical records, was required to argue this by telephone to a judge as to why she should be allowed to walk about as any normal person can and to make her medical decisions like any other adult person can make.
So things happened pretty quickly. The judge from the lower court ordered your client, Samantha Burton, to stay in the hospital. And as we know, she did stay for 3 days. And lost the baby anyway. Well, but what reason did the hospital and the doctor and the judge give for keeping Samantha Burton?
Well, they stated that they believed it was in the best interest of the child and that the state of Florida has the right when a woman is pregnant to do whatever is in the best interest of the child. And that's really what makes this case important, because that is the incorrect standard.
What do you think the standard should be?
Well, I think the standard is already laid out in the law that you have two very important fundamental rights, and that is a right of privacy, where you get your right to make your medical decisions, and you have a right of liberty, not to have your freedom restrained. And the state can really only infringe upon that when the state has a compelling interest. It's called a strict scrutiny standard. And then any intervention that the state wants to do has to be the most narrowly tailored intervention possible. If you look at the order that the judge issued in this case, he basically put no limit on any treatment that the doctor could prescribe. And I would argue that under that order, theoretically, the doctor could sacrifice the mother's life to preserve fetal health.
Well, you have bioethicists on your side, one here at Boston University who said it's unconscionable. People should have the absolute right to refuse treatment. But then, as you know, the state is saying its job is to preserve the life and health of the unborn child. And there was a case in Florida in 2004 in which a mentally ill woman was charged with murder for refusing a C-section. And so I'm just wondering, if there is precedent in the law, couldn't your client, Samantha Burton, have been charged with something if she hadn't stayed and her fetus subsequently died? Wouldn't that have made her liable?
I don't believe so, because, again, there's no showing that it was the actions of Samantha Burton that caused this pregnancy to go into distress. And I think the problem is when you have this threat of the government taking over the woman's body, or as in the example you cite, the government, you know, charging women when they have miscarriages with murder, that is a very dangerous position to be in. And I would suggest the overall effect on women's health is going to be very negative.
That's David Abrams, lawyer for Samantha Burton. As we said, she's now appealing the district court decision that she stay in the hospital in bed rest when she was pregnant last year, and this is all against her wishes. Well, there have been a handful of other cases similar to hers. Back in 1999, Tallahassee Memorial, the same hospital that ordered Burton to bed rest, was at the center of another battle. The hospital ordered a woman who wanted a natural childbirth to undergo a C-section. Now, that woman refused and left the hospital. Our next guest, William Meigs, the state attorney for Leon County, Florida, says he then went to her home and convinced her to return for the C-section. His office also argued the Samantha Burton bed rest case, and he joins us now. William, you say this isn't just about the unborn. It's your job to represent the hospital whenever it wants to force treatment?
To me, it's the case that we went down to the courthouse and did our job. If someone thinks we did our job incorrectly, if they decide they don't want the state attorney's office to be the party, the person representing the unborn and the people who can't defend themselves, if they want to change that legislatively or if they want to change it judicially, that's what they do. They make laws. I just try to follow.
What if the appeals court just says, the system's fine, but in this one case, in other words, the state attorney general should be involved, the judge should have been called, but in this one case, the judge should not have told her she had to have bed rest. She was competent. She could have been allowed to leave with a friend. She had children to take care of at home. The labor, the false labor was over. They had no right to keep her in that one case. It was just a mistake. What does that say to you?
Well, it won't be the first time mistakes have been made in our court system, and probably won't be the last.
Do you think it will say anything broader about whether or not the state should be telling pregnant women what to do?
The Supreme Court of Florida has said that in these situations, the process that we're to follow is for the doctor to contact the state attorney's office to represent them in a hearing before a judge to do what is in best interest of the person who is incapable of representing themselves, in this case the unborn.
Right.
In other cases it could be a 10-year-old child that parents will not let them have a blood transfusion or will not let them have the surgery that folks say the child will die if they don't get this particular kind of treatment.
So critics of what happened there in Florida are looking at it as the rights of pregnant women, but you see it much broader.
I'm not getting in the political debate about it. I have my own personal opinions about the unborn, but this is not about my personal opinions. It's not about abortion. It's not about First Amendment. It's about trying to protect those who can't speak for themselves.
That's William Meigs, a state attorney there in Leon County in Florida. Thanks so much.
You're sure welcome.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this story or anything on the program. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and you can leave a comment right there on the homepage. Back with beautiful music from Iceland by way of Nashville, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Let's face it, when we think country music, we think Iceland?
I'm on my own, right where I belong, since you've been gone.
That is Iceland's Lovisa Elizabeth Sæunnadóttir. She goes by Lalo and is being called the Icelandic Patsy Cline. Lucinda Williams says she's one of the best new artists she's seen in years, and you may have heard some of Lalo's earlier music on the hit ABC show Grey's Anatomy. Now, her new album, Farewell Good Night Sleep, is being released next month in the U.S. after an earlier CD went platinum in Iceland, the best-selling original album in that country that year. So, 27-year-old singer-songwriter Lalo joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, we're not surprised that hit music is coming out of Iceland, home of Björk, after all. But country music, is it part of the soundscape there, the way it is here?
In so many ways, we've got lots of influences from America and all over the world. Because we're a small island and we need to get products, music and clothes and stuff from all over the place. So somewhere in the country music slipped.
Came in
with the records. And yeah, I think most of Icelanders have heard like Patsy Cline and lots of country music in the public radio.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Well, and Patsy Cline of Crazy and I Fall to Pieces, she, of course, died very young at 30 in a plane crash. But even before that, she felt tragic to us. That's, you know, kind of the tone of her songs. There was just always sadness. Is that a part of what you pick up from country music?
Yeah, I think that's what I relate with when I write music. Even though I'm still quite young, 27, I've had quite a few experiences that make me of who I am. And I really like just being honest and try to share how I feel, even though it's hard sometimes.
We understand you were diagnosed with brain cancer not too long ago, and it was a tough time.
Yeah, it was quite a rough 2 years that I had. It took quite a while to diagnose it and find the treatment. But luckily, I had a really good team of doctors that got the whole thing just sorted. So I'm perfectly healthy today.
Good. Well, in fact, we know you have your guitar there and a backup singer. We'd love to hear a little of Little by Little. Can you do that for us?
Sure.
Little by little, you're breaking my heart. Piece by piece, you're tearing me apart. Time and time again, I'm crying over you. More and more, trying to forget about you. Time and time again.
That's Lalo singing Little by Little, You're Breaking My Heart from her forthcoming CD. How did this all start for you? Because I've read different stories. One that a friend slipped something, a song of yours, onto MySpace. Then we also read you used to play music at night and sell it during the day as a clerk at a music store in Reykjavik. And sometimes you'd sell it and sign it, you know, as you sold it. So how did it go from there to, you know, one of Iceland's biggest stars now?
From that song on the internet, there was a record label in Iceland that heard it and wanted to start working with me. And I got a record contract, and then the album came out, and I was working at a CD shop downtown at the time when the CD came out. And there were people coming into the store and seeing this new CD and were like, asking me, who is this? What is this new artist?
She's me, you would say.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I just pretended it was someone else. But from there, I was nominated for Icelandic Music Awards, and I won a few of them, so a lot of Icelandic people knew who I was.
Well, and now you're being compared to America's Nora Jones. Let's listen to another piece from Lalo. This is The Reason Why My Heart's in Misery.
I feel so low when day you know the reason.
Lalo, we understand you were a singer in a choir in school when you were young, but didn't try this solo singing until you were in your 20s. Why?
I think it started when I was a teenager that I got really shy about my voice. Even though I was in a choir, I always sang really low so nobody could hear me. Because, I don't know, I tried to record on a tape some music I was singing, and I really hated hearing my voice. So I was really sure that I couldn't sing. So I just concentrated on playing music. I played the bass in rock bands and in the church band and all over the place without singing. So I really enjoyed just being a bass player as well. And I never really focused on being a singer or a songwriter, but I just was led to that road, so I just had to follow.
Well, you pay homage to your earlier choir work with layers of voices, as we hear in the song My Secondhand Heart.
My secondhand heart, right from the start, will only cause you misery.
But Lalo, would you do us a favor, because many of us haven't been to Iceland. I know it's 300,000 people. That's sort of a town here in America. What is it like? Has it become very Americanized? What do you have, your own sort of indigenous folk or country music there?
We've got influences from all over. Like the old traditional Icelandic music is, I think I would say, from Scandinavian. But today we've got a mixture of all sorts of music. We've got folk music and country music and rock music and indie music. People are really busy. There's a lot of music coming from Iceland compared to how small the population is. So you can imagine that there's a very nice music scene there.
Lovisa, Lalo, we'd love for you to pick a song for us to play as we say goodbye. What should it be?
Maybe we could say goodbye with a song called Bye and Bye.
Let's do that. That's Iceland's Lovisa Elisabeth Sigrunadóttir, also known as Lalo, speaking with us about her album Farewell, Good Night's Sleep. It's being released in the U.S. in March. Lalo, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Thank you so much for having me here.